From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
On television sets around the world, we see acts of violence. Yet in most of Iraq, children are about to go back to school, parents are going back to work, and new businesses are being opened. Over 100 companies are now listed on the Iraqi Stock Exchange.
President Bush says the U.S. is winning in Iraq. His comments come as Iraq's unelected prime minister makes his first visit to the U.S. Today, we have a debate.
Instead of delivering liberty and prosperity, the U.S. occupation of Iraq has delivered spiraling chaos and a potentially endless civil war.
We'll be joined by two embedded journalists who spent extensive time on the front lines in Iraq. Then, with hurricanes raging in the Western Hemisphere, industry is pushing nuclear power as an answer to global warming. We'll be joined by the Nuclear Energy Institute and anti-nuclear doctor Helen Caldicott.
Nuclear power actually causes global warming. It produces 93% of the CFC gas in the country banned under the Montreal Protocol. It destroys the ozone layer, causes global warming, and it produces massive quantities of carbon dioxide in the production of the nuclear fuel.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The unelected Prime Minister of Iraq, Iyad Alawi, thanked the President and Congress for taking down the regime of Saddam Hussein. He told Congress, quote, "Things are moving in the right direction." Alawi also attacked critics of the occupation and suggested they may be fueling the opposition. He said, quote, "When political leaders sound the sirens of defeatism in the face of terrorism, it only encourages more violence." Alawi vowed the Iraqi election scheduled for January will go ahead as planned. But Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld yesterday revealed between 20% to 25% of Iraq may not take part in the elections because of continued violence. Rumsfeld admitted it would be, quote, "an election that's not quite perfect." The Wall Street Journal is reporting the Pentagon has plans to send 15,000 more troops to Iraq ahead of the elections. Although this marked Alawi's first address to Congress, he has had long ties to the U.S. government as a CIA asset and as head of the U.S.-supported Iraqi exile group called the Iraqi National Accord. Senator John Kerry criticized Alawi's speech and accused him of contradicting statements he made to the press just days before. Kerry said Alawi's remarks are, quote, "highly selective and designed to thank the president and ultimately help the president." Many press noted how Alawi's comments echoed, both in tone and content, key themes of Bush's reelection campaign. Last night, in an interview with the NewsHour on PBS, Alawi even attempted to connect Saddam Hussein with the September 11th attacks. He said, quote, "I assure you, if Saddam Hussein was still there, terrorists will be hitting there again at Washington and New York, as they did in the murderous attack in September. They'll be hitting also on other places in Europe and the Middle East." Violence continued yesterday in Iraq. In Mosul, a senior Iraqi oil official was shot dead yesterday. He'd previously survived two other assassination attempts. In the province of Anbar, one U.S. Marine was killed. 1,037 U.S. soldiers have now died in Iraq. Pipelines north of Baghdad and in Najaf were attacked yesterday, disrupting oil exports. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, two Egyptians working for a mobile phone company were kidnapped from their company's office. And the fate of the kidnapped Italian women, Simona Toretta and Simona Pari, is still unknown. Two Iraqi groups have now claimed to have executed the women, but the Italian government cast doubt on those claims. The women were in Iraq with the group abridged to Baghdad, which opposed the U.S. occupation. Also still unknown, the fate of their two Iraqi colleagues, a man and a woman. In other news related to Iraq, the U.S. National Guard is reporting that it will fall short of its recruiting goal for the first time in a decade. The Guard will likely fall about 5,000 members short of its goal of 56,000. Officials in Haiti are fearing the death toll from recent floods may soon rise over 2,000. Over 1,100 people have been confirmed dead, and another 1,200 are still missing. The country's third largest city, Gonaïves, is devastated. At least 4,000 homes are destroyed. Rivers of mud have flowed through the city. Survivors are shoveling mud out of their homes. The mayor of Gonaïves said, quote, "There's no water, no electricity, no communication. Many people don't have a place to sleep." The United Nations arrived yesterday to distribute food, but many aid vehicles have had difficulty reaching Gonaïves. Just outside the city, part of the main road is still submerged under 3 feet of water. The floods in Haiti are caused by Hurricane Ivan. Meanwhile, Florida is bracing to be hit by a fourth hurricane this season. Hurricane Jean is expected to hit land this weekend. On the campaign front, John Kerry's wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, told a crowd in Phoenix that Al-Qaeda leaders may be captured before the election. She said, quote, "I wouldn't be surprised if he appeared in the next month." The Council on American Islamic Relations has called on President Bush to explain why the singer Cat Stevens, also known as Yusuf Islam, was denied entry to the country this week. The singer was on board a transatlantic flight that, when officials learned his name appeared on a terror watch list. The plane was diverted to Maine, and the singer was denied entrance into the United States. In a statement, Kerr said that treating, quote, "mainstream and moderate Muslims like Yusuf Islam as if they're criminals or terrorists without bringing charges or allowing due process sends the message to the Islamic world that even those who seek peace and condemn terror are not fit to enter the United States." Back in London, Islam said he'd felt victimized by the process. He said, quote, "The one positive thing I can say is that a lot of security officers are very pleased because they got my autograph." In Britain, an influential Anglican group is planning to ask church leaders to impose a boycott on Israel and firms that do business there in protest of the occupation. This according to a report in The Guardian of London. The divestment campaign proposed by the Anglican Peace and Justice Network is similar to ones used to fight apartheid in South Africa. In July, the Presbyterian Church in the United States became the first major denomination to agree to a formal boycott of Israel. In California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has vetoed a bill that would have given 2 million illegal immigrants California driver's licenses. Last year, then-Governor Gray Davis signed into law a similar bill, but the legislature repealed it shortly after Davis was recalled. And here in New York, police are threatening to arrest participants in tonight's critical mass bike ride. Last month, police arrested and jailed 264 riders. The ride came shortly before the start of the Republican National Convention. It marked the first mass arrest during the week of the convention. Before last month's ride, police seldom made arrests during the monthly rides, which have been taking place over the last 10 years. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers and those of you on the internet at democracynow.org. Well, in his first official visit to the United States, Iraq's interim prime minister, Ayad Alawi, addressed a joint session of the U.S. Congress yesterday. He thanked the Bush administration and Congress for overthrowing the government of Saddam Hussein, and he claimed that the U.S. occupation authority and the Iraqi government were winning the battle against what he called terrorists operating in Iraq.
Alawi chastised the U.S. media for painting what he called an unfair picture of the situation in Iraq, saying what he sees on U.S. TV does not reflect the successes of the occupation. Later in the day, Alawi met with President Bush at the White House. The president praised Alawi's government and gave this assessment of the situation in Iraq.
On television sets around the world, we see acts of violence. Yet in most of Iraq, children are about to go back to school, parents are going back to work, and new businesses are being opened. Over 100 companies are now listed on the Iraqi Stock Exchange. And an average of 5 new companies are joining each week. Electricity has been restored above pre-war levels. Telephone service has increased dramatically. More than 2,000 schools have been renovated and millions of new textbooks have been distributed.
For his part, Prime Minister Alawi said that despite the daily bloodshed, regular beheadings, and an increasingly visible resistance, Iraq is becoming more stable every day. He said 14 or 15 of Iraq's 18 provinces, quote, are completely safe. He highlighted what he said were the economic successes in the new Iraq.
Finally, our economic plan is to improve the everyday lives of Iraqis as we deliver both political and security progress. Here, thanks to a large extent to the generous security and reconstruction funding approved by the United States Congress, work is underway. Oil pipelines are being repaired, basic services improved, streets and homes rebuilt, schools, hospitals, and clinics reopened. Thousands of Iraqis have new jobs. Salaries have been increased dramatically, in many cases, 5 or 4 times over. Iraq's economy feed from the strange hold of a failed Ba'athist ideology is finally starting to flourish.
As Alawi made his way around Washington, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry was campaigning in Ohio, where he commented on the statements by both Bush and Alawi that the U.S. is winning in Iraq.
Prime Minister and the president are here, obviously, to put their best face on the policy. But the fact is that the CIA estimates, the reporting, the ground operations, and the troops all tell a different story.
With the recent beheadings of two American contractors kidnapped in Iraq, both Bush and Alawi were asked a number of times yesterday about what appear to be stepped-up attacks by resistance groups. Again, Prime Minister Alawi.
I meet personally every now and then with the fringes of the so-called resistance to try and talk them into respecting law and order and to throw their arms. And I ask them, in a very honest, very open way, I say to them, what do you want to achieve? Could we know exactly what you want to achieve? Do you want to bring Saddam back from the hole in the ground, living like a rat? You want to bring him back to rule Iraq? Or do you want to bring bin Laden or similar persons to bin Laden to rule Iraq? If you want to do this, we will fight you room to room, house to house. If you want to be part of the political process, you have to be part of the political process. You are welcome. If you do not want the multinational force in Iraq, I was talking to Fallujah people recently, to tribes, ex-army officers, ex-Saddam loyalists. If you want the multinational force out, win the elections, go to the United Nations, talk to the Security Council, and tell them we don't need the multinational force. But I tell you what is going to happen. If you ask the multinational force to leave prematurely, this is me talking to the Fallujah people, your country will be in ruins. And we cannot now on our feet stand and fight terrorism and global terrorism. These are realities. And once you are in Iraq, I will be my host. I can put you together with these people in my home, and you can talk to them, and you can find out yourselves that the Iraqis tremendously, by and large, respect the United States and respect the other partners in the coalition for helping Iraq, not only in liberation, but now in helping Iraq to rebuild itself and to rebuild its institutions.
To discuss Iyad Alawi's visit and the current situation in Iraq, we're joined by two embedded journalists spent in extensive time in the front lines of Iraq. Christian Parenti joins us in the studio, correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of the forthcoming book, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq. Over the past year, he's been embedded with U.S. troops and has spent time with Iraqi resistance groups. On the telephone with us is the editor-in-chief of the American Enterprise magazine, Carl Zinsmeister. He's author of the new book, Dawn Over Baghdad, How the U.S. Military is Using Bullets and Ballots to Remake Iraq. He has spent extensive time in Iraq embedded with U.S. troops. Carl Zinsmeister, let's begin with you. Is the U.S. winning in Iraq right now?
In a two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward fashion, I would say yes, Amy. I'm not Pollyannish about it. I think this is a very difficult fight. But I also think the stakes are very high, and any difficult, important battle like this, which I would really say is the equivalent of fighting Nazism or communism or other sorts of long-term struggles, in that context, I think in 18 months we have made considerable progress, and yes, we are moving forward.
I'd like to ask you, though, the in terms of the conflict on the ground, the reports were that in August there were as many as 87 attacks a day against U.S. forces. So it seems that the pace of the conflict is actually increasing in terms of the resistance to the United States forces.
I expect between now and the election there will be increases in the intensity of the fighting. And as I say, this is a difficult urban war. We have to understand that it's not a something that we can treat lightly. At the same time, I basically have a historical perspective. I recently sat down and looked at where we were in other American wars at an equivalent time. We are 18 months into the war in Iraq. And so I sat down, for instance, where were we in 18 months into World War II? And at that point, we were losing about 350 or 400 soldiers a day. We were losing one or two a day in Iraq. The casualty rate is just a fraction of what it was there. In the 18 months into World War II, the Germans had taken over almost all of Europe. The Japanese had swept us out of the Pacific. The Japanese were actually on American soil in the Aleutian Islands at this point in World War II. And when we finally kicked them out, in about the 18th month, actually, it took 1,000 dead American soldiers to do that in a two-day battle. This is what wars are like. They're ugly. They're awful. That's why they are last resorts. We are involved in a war now that we really would rather not be involved in, but we were dragged into it. This is a fight that most Americans would rather not be participating in, but the fight against Middle Eastern extremism is one we can't just walk away from. And now that we're involved, we have to win it, and I would argue that the losses, both in human life and in financial costs, are ones we can bear, and that if we will persevere, we will be rewarded for.
Christian Parenti, your response.
Well, Carl's analogy with World War II is completely misplaced. What's going on in Iraq is an urban guerrilla war. To compare it with a conventional war is to completely miss the point and to misunderstand what the dynamics are there. The U.S. military faces a profoundly political and economic crisis. The problems in Iraq are not just some sort of coherent enemy versus the U.S. Army. There's all sorts of internal problems that are being exacerbated by the U.S. occupation. And things have gotten worse and worse over 18 months. The entire country is now completely out of control. It is impossible to travel the roads in Iraq. It's really impossible to stress enough how really chaotic and dangerous Iraq is, that even Haifa Street, which is essentially Fifth Ave in Baghdad, it's the main road on the west side of the Tigris River, that there are areas of there which are occasionally now considered no-go areas for U.S. troops, is absolutely radical escalation in the nature of the violence there. And the U.S. Army faces a problem in Iraq that it cannot solve because reconstruction has broken down, and reconstruction has broken down because Bush-connected firms, Halliburton and Bechtel, have taken huge sums of money and done essentially nothing with it. And Iraqis are not getting jobs. Their services have stalled out at a dilapidated state, and they are extremely angry. They're incandescent with rage that they that their economy is ruined and that they are daily humiliated by aggressive searches from U.S. troops. And that's why more and more mainstream Iraqis, even people who hated Saddam Hussein, I interviewed resistance fighters who had been tortured and imprisoned by Saddam Hussein. That's why people like that are going out of their way to kill U.S. soldiers and sabotage the infrastructure. And to resort to analogies of the Aleutian Islands and the dark days of the early World War II is complete fantasy and is the very type of denial that got this country into this mess.
We're going to go to break, then come back with this discussion. We're talking to Christian Parenti, correspondent for The Nation magazine. He actually heads off to Afghanistan today, who is embedded in Iraq. Also, Carl Zinsmeister as well, an embedded journalist. His new book is called Dawn Over Baghdad. We'll be back in a minute. Taufik, an Iraqi musician who recorded this as the bombs were falling on Baghdad. He was in Baghdad. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Christian Parenti, correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of the forthcoming book, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq. And Carl Zinsmeister is also with us. His book, The Dawn Over Baghdad, How the U.S. Military is Using Bullets and Ballots to Remake Iraq. Carl Zinsmeister is the editor-in-chief of the American Enterprise magazine. We wanted to play just a short clip of Richard Perle, who was speaking at the American Enterprise Institute a year ago this week.
And a year from now, I'll be very surprised if there is not some grand square in Baghdad that is named after President Bush.
Richard Perle, a year ago, September 22nd, 2003. Carl Zinsmeister, your response. Do you think we're close to that point?
No, I don't think we're close to that particular point. I don't think it's a particularly important point in any case. I think the whole point in Iraq is to have it functioning as a stable society that doesn't kill its own people, that doesn't threaten its neighbors, that doesn't threaten us. I don't think it has to be an America-philic society. I don't think it has to be a society that models itself on us at all. Let me point out, my observations on Iraq are based on 3 months in the country, a lot of time walking the streets, and nothing more. I have no sort of theoretical position on Iraq. I have lots of empirical opinions based on what I've observed. And one of the most important things I've observed that hasn't been reported, Amy, is that Iraq is a much less fanatical country than most of the media coverage implies. This is based not only on my anecdotal observation, but on polling done in the country, including by my magazine. We commissioned the very first poll ever done in the country in cooperation with Zogby International. And what we and other pollsters have found is that there's a big middle, and then particularly there's a big Shiite middle in this country, which is much more sort of acclimatized to modernity and very anxious to move on and not attach itself to any of the extremists operating in the country. And they just don't get much attention. We saw this, for instance, in Najaf. I mean, Najaf, what just was completed in Najaf last month was a really underappreciated accomplishment. You had, you know, extremists hold up in this mosque in Najaf, very holy mosque, really an inflammatory situation. And through a combination of military pressure and some savvy diplomatic involvement, we managed to kill lots of terrorists, lots of extremists in the city without destroying the mosque, to get Muqtada Sadr to retreat, to clear the city out. And the important point is that the Najaf residents, who are mostly this big Shiite middle, were extremely pleased with this result, did not believe that the terrorists who had occupied the mosque represented them. They were angry and thrilled to have them gone. And this is the kind of quiet sort of squeezing pressure that we're going to have to continue to exert. And there are lots of Iraqis who will be pleased if we are able to achieve that.
But Carl Zinsmeister, precisely that issue of a modernist society, really, because if one criticism you can't make of the Saddam Hussein regime is that it promoted religious fundamentalism in any way, hasn't the American occupation, in essence, actually polarized the society and created much more of a more radical, made Iraq into a base now for radical fundamentalists and those who would see their religion under assault in the U.S. occupation?
There's no question. We are the kind of focus of all sorts of grievances and unhappinesses. And those include not only religious grievances, but all sorts of opposition. And you know, we know that there are people coming in from outside, from all over the Middle East, to come to Iraq to fight us for that reason. You know, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think those grievances were there. I think that we didn't create them. We are simply kind of focusing them in one place. There was hatred for the United States dating back 25 years in this region. There was hatred under the Clinton administration. There was hatred under Jimmy Carter. You know, I date this fight against Middle Eastern extremism to 1979, when the Iranians took over our embassy and held our people hostage for a full year. And the 9/11 attacks to me were simply the exclamation point at the end of a very long sentence. And what we learned, I think, was that there are people in the Middle East who will keep biting us and biting us and biting us until something is done to create more humane societies, more decent governments that don't produce these frustrated legions of homicidally, you know, angry young men.
Former President Jimmy Carter is quoted in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution this week saying he hopes the U.S. will withdraw its troops from Iraq next year if Iraqis are able to govern themselves by then. He said bloodshed in the country would be tremendously reduced if Iraqis knew U.S. troops are not there to stay. Can you respond to Carl Zinsmeister?
I think that, you know, with all due respect to, you know, Carl, work on the ground there, he's completely wrong on every count. And like the Bush administration, is internally inconsistent. The project in Iraq is, in its own terms, completely out of control. The U.S. is incapable of controlling the road between the Green Zone and the airport. Building democracy, transforming the Middle East, that's all off the table. What Iraq now faces is the potential endless civil war as extremist populations, as extremist leadership develops out of the crisis and pulls the mainstream of society into opposing camps. The U.S. is exacerbating this through its economic policies and through its military policies. And the fact of the matter is that as things get worse and worse, the U.S. escalates the killing. What happened in Najaf was not some sort of public relations coup. The people who lost their hotels, the middle class of Najaf, are furious, yes, at Sadr's people, but also at the U.S. for destroying their downtown. And what happened there was absolutely criminal on the part of U.S. troops. In terms of this logic of killing lots of terrorists, that, again, completely misunderstands the logic of guerrilla warfare. The point is not to kill. I mean, there's no way the U.S. can kill all of the extremists and then it's over. Every person they kill creates another potential fighter. They're constantly alienating more and more people with every day of combat. And the sooner that people realize this, the sooner the U.S. will get out of there. And in terms of historical analogy, since Carl made a historical analogy, the real historical analogy here is Vietnam, though there are many, many differences with Vietnam. But we have this national intelligence assessment that's come out. It's clear that people on the inside of this administration realize that they have lost, just as Kennedy and Johnson did in Vietnam. Yet they're going to, just like Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon, they're going to hang in there and they're going to kill and they're going to allow working class kids to go die and they're going to spend more and more of the money that we don't have in this country until the crisis is absolutely untenable. And I really think that we have to be serious about the fact that the U.S. is the problem. It's not the solution. What we have done in Iraq is unleash a set of dynamics for which there is potentially, I hate to sound cynical, but for which there's potentially no solution. And that country could face a civil war that goes on for decades. And there's no way the U.S. can control that. And the longer the U.S. is there, the more brutal its tactics will be, and the more civilians will die.
But let me ask you...
And the more unstable the entire region is as a result. The entire region is primed for further instability.
But let me ask you, the reality is, given the instability that now exists, there are those who say, well, for the United States to pull out its troops now would be to actually allow total chaos to exist. What's your response to that?
I've come to this conclusion very, very carefully. Many of my friends on the left are much earlier calling for U.S. withdrawal. And it's with much reluctance that I've come to the position that I really think that the U.S. does have to pull out as soon as possible, because the U.S. cannot stabilize the situation. The U.S. is exacerbating the situation. And yes, the U.S. will leave Iraq as a complete disaster, as rubble, as a pile of corpses, with probably some sort of civil war going on. But staying there exacerbates it and helps, you know, spread this further into the region.
When you went into Iraq, Christian, you were embedded with which?
I was embedded with the Florida National Guard and then with the 82nd Airborne in Fallujah.
And did you spend time outside of that unembedded?
Yeah, I spent time throughout the so-called Sunni Triangle in Ramadi, Fallujah, Samarra, Bakuba, and met with resistance fighters in Balad, north of Baghdad, and in Baghdad, and in Sadr City.
Carl Zinsmeister, who were you embedded with?
Originally with the 82nd Airborne, and I've spent time in primarily Baghdad and Fallujah, and places in between.
Your response to Christian Parenti's very dire assessment right now?
I just think it's inaccurate. I mean, Iraq is a big country.
It's not inaccurate. It's reported every single day in the newspaper.
Could I finish, please? Iraq is a big country. If you laid it on the United States, it would cover all of New England down to sort of Virginia area. It is even more multifaceted ethnically and otherwise. In most of the country, places like Samawa, for instance, where I spent part of the hot war, this is a quiet country. This is a stable place. This is a place that's getting on with life. In the Kurdish areas in the north, it is an extremely well-functioning society. In much of the Shiite territory, it is a basically quiet, stable place. There are selected areas which are hellish. That, I think, is important to differentiate. I think the main point I would make that makes this very different than Vietnam is that this is not a popular uprising. What this is a minority, a very well-armed and very sadistic minority that is fighting us. They have the fear factor over much of the rest of the population. They do not, however, have the support of much of the rest of the population. This is not a popular movement. If, for instance, you look at Zarqawi, the al-Qaeda leader who is setting off most of the car bombs, Zarqawi does not even consider either Shiites or Kurds, which are together about 80% of the Iraqi population, does not even consider them Muslims. The idea that this could ever become a popular leader is ludicrous. What you have here is very dangerous minorities that, as I say, have cowed and intimidated much of the population.
Zarqawi is irrelevant. This is a popular uprising. You're describing an Iraq that existed maybe for 2 months last summer. Even the South is riddled with violence, and if not political violence, then all sorts of criminality. A good friend of mine was kidnapped in Basra, which is supposedly peaceful. This idea that most of the country is peaceful is simply not borne out by facts, and witnessed by the fact that you and I, as white American journalists, can no longer drive the roads in allegedly safe provinces.
I think that's the least important factor. I mean, it is definitely a dangerous place for foreigners.
But no, it is, in fact. It is, in fact, a very important factor, because what it means is that the image that we get in the press, though presenting chaos, actually minimizes how much violence there is, because it is so hard to get to places like Ramadi these days and spend some time there and see the fighting. And what we learned from our Arab colleagues is that the situation is really, really out of control.
You can't, the Americans can't safely drive a lot of the mountain roads in Venezuela or the Honduras or any lots of other.
That's
places.
Not true. I've done that in Venezuela. It's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous comparison.
Hold on 1 second. Now, I'd like to ask Mr. Zinsmeister, this whole issue, as you're saying, that other parts of the country are safe. I look at the dispatches, for instance, in the New York Times every day, and even the Iraqi correspondents that are providing information in places like Mosul and other cities are not identified for their safety, according to the New York Times blurbs at the bottom of the articles. Why would even the Arab correspondents in safe areas have to worry if the security situation is not as bad as Mr. Parenti is pointing out?
Look, there, as I say, there are whole swaths of this country which are basically functioning very much like they did before any war started. And there are all kinds of sort of macro indicators of this. I mean, this is a country where now a third of the population has satellite television. That's higher than in this country. There have been something like a million cars imported over the last year. There is a consumer bloom going on in Iraq, which simply belies the idea that everyone is hiding in their basement, hunkered down. There are all kinds of businesses being formed. This is not, you know, paradise on earth, but as I say, there are large portions of the country that are much more concerned about other things than their safety. I know lots of Iraqi families who vacationed in the north this summer, who piled into their cars, drove up into the mountains, and spent some summer vacation for the very first time in their lives. In many cases,
this is like desperate grasping at straws. The simple fact of the matter is that, you know, I wish that you were right. I really do. Even though I didn't support this invasion and I don't support the occupation, I really wish that what you said were saying was true. But the fact of the matter, which will be borne out by history, is that that Iraq is falling apart. And it's incredibly tragic, and that the U.S. is responsible, as witnessed by audits about how Iraqi oil money has been spent, White House audits, international UN audits, the fact that there are 21 criminal investigations underway about how reconstruction was handled. You know, all of this sort of corruption and venality and ideological delusion and hallucinations are what have delivered this truly tragic collapse in a society. And I really wish what you were saying was true, and I hope I'm wrong, but I have faith that history will prove my description correct and yours to be total fantasy, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's a fascinating theory, Christian, but I don't think that the Halliburton had anything to do with the ankle-deep sewage that I saw when I walked into the Iraqi cities in March of 2003, or the ruined schools or the other devastation. This is a society that was ruined before the war started. Progress has been made since that time.
No, progress hasn't been made. That's the whole point, is that Halliburton, actually Bechtel is in charge of cleaning up the sewage in Baghdad, and they have done nothing. I was just there in July, and the sewage is still ankle deep, and there's no sign of reconstruction. There are no Iraqis in the street with shovels. They're in the street with AK-47s and RPGs.
Christian, you're inaccurate about that. I've spent time at the Iraqi, and right in Dawn Over Baghdad, in my book, I write about the time I spent at the sewage plant in Baghdad, and it is being rebuilt. I think you're really kind of...
No. I have an article in The Nation. I visited all of those sewage plants. There are three main sewage plants. One of them, Kirk, just got online by 20%. For the entire year, the main three sewage plants were dumping sewage, massive amounts of sewage into the Tigris.
And when did they break? Were they broken by the U.S. Army?
Yes, they were.
No, they were.
They were broken, not intentionally by the U.S. Army. They weren't targeted, but fighting.
Untrue.
No.
That's
fighting happened
untrue.
In the sewage plants, in the Rostamia South and North sewage plants in particular. They were knocked out by fighting. To the credit of the U.S. Army, they were not targeted. But the point is, they have not been fixed by Bechtel and Halliburton. And if they had been, the situation might be quite different.
On a lighter note, you're leaving for Afghanistan, Christian Parenti, if there can be a lighter note in this situation. Maybe you can examine what the Afghan army is doing in Iraq. We're going to turn right now to a clip of President Bush yesterday in that joint news conference that he held with Iyad Alawi. This is President Bush.
Our strategy is to help the Iraqis help themselves. It's important that we train Iraqi troops. There are nearly 100,000 troops trained. The Afghan National Army is a part of the Army. By the way, it was the Afghan National Army that went into Najaf and did the work there. There's a regular army being trained, there are border guards being trained, there are police being trained. That's a key part of our mission.
The Afghan army went into Najaf. Will you be investigating this?
Well, if I run into any Afghan army vets from Najaf, I'll let you know.
Girls and Smeister, final comment.
Well, you know, this is a part of the world that has had a tragic history for a long, long time. We did not create that tragic history. We are trying very hard to respond to it. Within the next 6 months, there is a very good chance that both Afghanistan and Iraq are going to hold elections. I think we need not, we must not forget that that would be an incredible historical accomplishment, something never, ever done in either of those societies before. Will they be Switzerland and heaven on earth? Absolutely not. But will that be something much better than anything they've ever had in the past and something we can be proud of? I would say absolutely yes.
Unfortunately, you know, you're in massive denial about what has happened over the last 12 years. The U.S. has, in fact, played a very direct role in destroying Iraq. It didn't have a perfect history before that. But to deny our responsibility of two wars, sanctions, and now this completely botched and brutal occupation is bad for everyone, the U.S. and Iraqis, and ultimately the entire world.
On that note, we're going to have to leave it there. Certainly, it's an issue we will continue to discuss on a regular basis. We have been joined by Christian Parenti, who is correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of the forthcoming book, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq. Also, Carl Zinsmeister on the phone with us from Washington. He's editor-in-chief of the American Enterprise magazine. His book is called On Over Baghdad, How the U.S. Military is Using Bullets and Ballots to Remake Iraq. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the nuclear industry is saying nuclear power is an answer to global warming. We'll have a debate. Stay with us.
Of man. Are you ready for the great atomic power? Will you rise and meet your savior in the air? Will you shout or will you cry when the fire ain't from on high? Are you ready for the great atomic fire?
There is one way to escape it. Meet the Lord. Give your heart and soul to Jesus. He will be your shielding sword. He will surely stay beside you and you'll never taste of death. For your soul will fly to safety and eternal peace and rest. Are you ready?
The Leuven Brothers, The Great Atomic Power, here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Florida and the Bahamas are bracing for Hurricane Jean, which is churning westward in the Atlantic Ocean with winds of over 100 miles per hour. If Jean hits Florida, it will be the fourth hurricane to hit the state this season. But as Florida braces, it is the Caribbean that has been hit the hardest by hurricanes this fall and summer. The government of the Bahamas has issued a warning to its citizens. Last weekend, Haiti was devastated by Jean, which at the time was a tropical storm. It triggered flooding and massive mudslides.
More than 1,100 people have been killed in Haiti. More than 1,200 are still unaccounted for. The death toll is expected to rise more than 2,000. The hurricane also killed two people in Puerto Rico, 11 in the Dominican Republic. In Florida, hurricanes killed 85 people, caused billions of dollars in damage. As hurricane after hurricane devastates the Caribbean and U.S. coastal states, many are raising questions about the role global warming has played, though that issue is not raised very much in the media. Right now, the nuclear industry is posing a possible solution. nuclear power as the answer to global warming. Today, we'll have a debate. We're joined by Helen Caldicott, one of the world's most respected anti-nuclear activists. She is a physician, a founder of Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, now president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. She's written many books, among them Missile Envy, Nuclear Madness, What You Can Do. Scott Peterson is on the phone with us. He is spokesperson for the D.C.-based Nuclear Energy Institute. We go first to Scott Peterson. Why is nuclear power, do you think, the answer?
Well, it's not the answer. It's one of the answers that we're going to need if we plan to meet the electricity demands that we're going to have in the near future, and that's a 40% increase in electricity demand over the next 20 years. It's also the largest clean air source of electricity that we have in the United States, producing electricity already for one of five homes and businesses. So to meet the electricity demand that we know we're going to have over the next 20 years and to make sure that we have sources of electricity that are clean air sources, including renewables, hydropower, and nuclear, we have to maintain the nuclear energy supplies that we have today, and we have to start on a fairly robust expansion program for nuclear energy, making sure that we build reactors that continue to be safe, continue to provide affordable electricity for consumers, but also continue to provide clean air benefits that have led to really an improvement in our air quality over the past several years in the United States.
Helen Caldicott.
Well, I've just discovered from the Department of Energy's data that the enrichment of uranium produces 93% per year of the CFC gas in this country, which is currently banned under the Montreal Protocol because it produces destruction of the ozone layer. And in Australia, we've got an epidemic of skin cancer because the ozone's so thin. Also, CFC gas, which is the refrigerant gas banned, is up to 20,000 times more potent global warmer than carbon dioxide, which accounts for 50% of global warming. But also to enrich uranium, they use two 1,000-megawatt coal-fired plants to enrich the uranium itself for nuclear power. So massive quantities of carbon dioxide are produced in that very process, but also in building the reactor, storing the radioactive waste for hundreds of thousands of years. So, and the other thing is that nuclear power releases millions of curies of unregulated radiation into the air every day or every year, millions of curies every year of noble gases and of tritium, which is very biologically dangerous and very carcinogenic. And it also creates massive quantities of radioactive waste, which lasts for up to 500,000 years, which inevitably will leak into the ecosphere, bioconcentrated each step of the food chain, the algae, the crustaceans, the little fish, the big fish. We can't taste the radiation, we can't smell it, we can't see it. Cancer takes years to evolve. If I sneeze on you, you're sneezing in 2 days because the incubation time for a cold is 2 days. But for cancer, when you've been exposed to radiation, is any time from 5 to 60 years. And the cancer doesn't wear a little flag saying what it was caused by years ago. So it's what is predicted medically because of the nuclear waste from nuclear power is epidemics of particularly childhood cancer because they're very sensitive to radiation and leukemia and genetic disease for the rest of time. And we're not the only species that have genes and get cancer. All other species do as well. So nuclear power is extraordinarily biologically dangerous. It produces filthy air with radioactive isotopes, carbon dioxide, and CFC gas. And the nuclear industry has been lying in its advertisements, being put out consistently on NPR and PBS and the like. You mustn't lie when you're talking about medical and environmental conditions. That's scientifically inappropriate and unethical to lie.
Scott Peterson, your response, and also given the fact that in the United States there hasn't been a new nuclear plant started to be built now in decades, why would you expect the American public to suddenly want to change their perspective on the dangers of nuclear power?
Well, the American public's perspective on nuclear energy has actually been supportive for many years now because they recognize the benefits that they get from nuclear energy. And they also recognize the safety of our plants, particularly over the last decade. 64% of the U.S. public believes that we should build more nuclear plants, and we are now setting the stage in this country, working both with industry and government, to begin building advanced reactors that have even better safety features. They're going to be more cost-effective to build, so the consumer electricity rates are going to be lower. And they're also going to be built in a manner that takes advantage of existing nuclear power plants. So we're building them at the same sites and actually using less land and taking advantage of the land and the transmission systems that we already have. So we're taking a number of steps to make sure that we can meet consumer electricity demands as they continue to rise in the future, but meet them in a way that also protects the environment and recognizes that that we need to make changes in how we look at our air quality and how we combine the imperatives of having electricity and also protecting our environment. If you took the nuclear plants that we have today out of the electricity...
But if I can interrupt you for 1 second, what about the other part of my question, which is your response to Helen Caldicott's claims of the actual polluting nature of nuclear plants?
Well, I wouldn't know where to begin with some of those claims because a lot of them just aren't factually correct.
But they are, you see, because I got the data from the department. Listen, they're correct.
Every federal regulation that is on the books from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in terms of radiation release from our plants. We meet every single requirement. Our plants are monitored daily by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to make sure that we're well within those limits. So we meet not only the NRC limits, we meet environmental limits in terms of the temperature of water that has to come out of our plants as we use cooling water. So I would say that that Helen Caldicott, as usual, is engaged in a scare tactic with the public, giving them false information. For example, the uranium enrichment of our fuel for every single nuclear power plant is powered by a nuclear power plant. So we use now nuclear power plants to power the conversion of uranium into our fuel, so there's no emissions even in that process. And so, a lot has happened in our industry in the last decade to make our industry even cleaner in terms of emissions than what it had been in the production of nuclear power. And I would just say that there are a number of life cycle emission studies that have been done in the last 10 years that show that nuclear energy for the environment, along with renewables, are the cleanest sources of electricity from beginning to end for consumers and for the environment.
One of the early controversies in the Bush administration was who Vice President Dick Cheney consulted with in his energy task force in shaping energy policy. Was your organization, Scott Peterson, the Nuclear Energy whole consortium of nuclear energy groups, consulted with by Vice President Cheney?
We typically try to speak to all new leadership that comes into Washington, whether it's an administration or it's members of Congress, to talk to them about energy policy and the importance of nuclear energy.
And did you meet with Vice President Cheney? Did the actual Nuclear Energy Institute meet with Vice President Cheney?
We did have a representative as part of the meetings that he had with several groups, including environmentalists. So we were.
Which environmentalists were with you?
We were not in a meeting with environmentalists. He had several meetings with different groups.
You mean that he told you about, but you didn't know, you weren't there with meetings?
I was personally not at the meeting, so I don't know who was in attendance at the meeting.
Because we're still trying to find out who it was that Vice President Dick Cheney met with in shaping his energy policy. But how important, Dr. Helen Caldicott, is nuclear power as part of the planks that he has set forward?
Vice President Cheney wants to build up to 50 new nuclear power plants in the next 20 years. Terribly dangerous from a biological and medical perspective. As a physician who treats children with cystic fibrosis, the commonest genetic disease of childhood, most and fatal, and there are 3,000 such diseases, I just dread to think what nuclear power will do over future generations. We're leaving a legacy to future generations which will be horrendous.
I think if you look at the health benefits of nuclear energy, though, Helen, you have to agree that where you have major urban areas that need electricity but are now coping with particles in the air that cause asthma and other breathing disorders, we have to have cleaner sources of electricity.
So nuclear power, produces massive quantities
of... It's not just the industry.
It's the MIT and Harvard. It's Princeton. It's the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and several other research that has been done over the last few years that point to the need for more nuclear power plants in addition to renewable sources of electricity to provide that electricity and maintain our health and our air quality into the future.
Scott Peterson, let me ask you about another aspect of this issue, which is the byproduct, the waste product of nuclear plants. Our nation is still battling over what it's going to do with the nuclear waste from the current nuclear energy industry and the continuing battle over Yucca Mountain. Wouldn't more plants only exacerbate the problem of this highly radioactive nuclear waste?
Well, all sources of energy production have a byproduct, and we've been managing the used fuel from reactors on site, waiting for this federal government solution for a permanent repository. The government has made progress, and they've selected a site in the Nevada desert, and they're in the process now of developing a license application they would submit to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which must approve this site. So we're looking forward to about the 2010 time frame when this repository would be open and ready to accept fuel from our sites.
Dr. Helen,
okay, this material is radioactive.
Repository for this fuel. There's no question about that.
This material is radioactive for the next half a million years.
It will also be available in the future.
You can't get it word in ageways.
Quantity of this fuel.
Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Thank you. This material is radioactive for up to half a million years, and as I said, will leak inevitably into the biosphere, get into the water, get into our food chains, and produce cancer, leukemia, and genetic disease for the rest of time. What we're doing is really criminal. And I think the best person who talked about this was Einstein when he said the splitting of the atom changed everything save man's mode of thinking. Thus, we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. Nuclear energy makes 20% of the electricity people currently use. Europe has the same standard of living as America and uses 50% less electricity because they conserve. You can turn your clothes dries off, hang your clothes outside, let the nuclear reactor in the sky dry your clothes, hang them by the furnace in the winter. There are many ways to conserve energy, but we haven't focused on one very important area, and that is terrorism. You've got a reactor here in New York, 35 miles from New York, three reactors actually. In a 1,000 megawatt nuclear power plant is as much long-lived radiation as that released by the explosion of 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. And in the cooling pools next to the reactor with the spent radioactive fuel is 30 times as much as that. The reactor itself is protected by a very thick containment vessel of concrete, but the cooling pool is protected by a roof the same construction as a Kmart roof. You could fly a small plane into that cooling pool. I could melt Indian Point down in a couple of hours. It's very easy. There are many ways to do it. And if that cooling pool melts and burns and the radiation blows towards New York with weather conditions prevailing such that it would, millions of people will be irradiated and die of acute radiation illness with their hair falling out, vomiting and bleeding to death within 2 weeks.
There would be an epidemic of leukemia
5 years later. Solid cancers would appear 15 to 60 years later. Up to 250,000 men would be rendered temporarily sterile. Up to 250,000 women would stop menstruating, many permanently. There would be 1,500 spontaneous abortions, many babies born with tiny heads, microcephaly, because the developing neurological system is very susceptible to radiation. There'd be many cretins born and the like. So we're talking about a medical catastrophe.
Scott Peterson, your response very briefly. We have 15 seconds.
I have to say that if you listen to Helen, she makes she just really uses a lot of scare tactics to try to portray a picture that simply isn't going to happen. We have tremendous security around those facilities. There have been a number of studies done since 9/11, both by the industry, by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and other independent agencies that show that even if a wide-body aircraft were to go into our nuclear power plants...
3 seconds to go.
We have a conference in Chicago on October 15th and 16th called Nuclear Power and Children's Health. Go to our website, nuclearpolicy.org, find out about it. Come, because Chicago is surrounded by 14 nuclear power plants. Many are dilapidated and aging.
Helen Caldicott and Scott Peterson, thank you very much. And their websites will be on ours at democracynow.org. As we head in this election year traveling, I'll be in Durango on Saturday night and to Arizona, where one of the debates will be. We'll be in Arizona Sunday night in Tucson, Monday night in Yuma, Tuesday night in Phoenix, Wednesday night Santa Fe. Follow our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.